Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and the so-called sharing economy has brought convenience and lower prices to the way we catch a ride, book a hotel room, and even get odd jobs done around the house. However, not all the results are as positive as hailing a cab more easily or calling one on your phone. And after participating in the gig economy himself, my next guest, Stephen Hill, now a senior fellow at the New America Foundation, says that these changes are taking us back to a pre-New Deal economy. He lays it out in his new book, Raw Deal, How the Uber Economy and Runaway Capitalism Are Screwing American Workers. And he's here to talk about it. Hello, Stephen Hill. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. It's a pleasure to be here.
To start out, what do people mean really when they use the term sharing economy? What do you mean?
Well, the sharing economy is a loosely associated group of companies, and most of them recent companies. These companies are not very old, that started in Silicon Valley area. And what they do is they use web and app-based technologies to connect a buyer and a seller and to get rid of the middle person. I mean, sort of like what Amazon has done for books and now for just about everything, or E-Trade did if you wanted to swap your things, except they've taken those models and taken them next step further, where now you can, as you say, rent out a home, or you can, you know, get a ride, a taxi, basically, or you can, you can rent out your own labor, or you can, you know, purchase labor from someone if you need some errands done or chores, or and there's all sorts of platforms now that are doing all sorts of things where you can, you know, rent your drill or rent other goods that you have. So it's really these companies don't have a lot in common in terms of what they're offering to buy or sell, but what they have in common is the platform and how they connect the buyer and the seller.
Your book gives many examples of how precarious life as a member of the gig economy can be, citing real people who struggle to make ends meet. And you lived this experience yourself, I see, after you lost your job and began freelancing as a journalist. So what was the most surprising aspect of becoming a member of this new workforce?
Well, the most surprising thing was just how insecure it really is. I mean, some of it was just really nuts and bolts things, like as a freelancer, for example, there's no employer there that pays their share of Social Security and Medicare. So right there, that's 8% more gone from your income, or almost 8%. But on top of that, you really have to, you know, most people who work at a steady job, they go to work 9 to 5 or whatever their hours are, and every moment they're in that job is paid time. You are, you know, if you go to a meeting with your coworkers, that's paid time. If you're just standing around the water cooler, that's paid time. But with the gig economy, the only time you're paid for is when you're producing that product that you're being paid to produce. You know, whether it's a report or designing a graphic logo or what have you, you're only paid when you produce that final product, and then you're not paid to look for the next job, and you're not paid for any kind of rest breaks.
You're describing freelancing. Freelancing has been around a long time. So what's new?
Well, the new thing with the gig economy is it hires more freelancers and more contractors. So it's made it easier to hire and fire people. If you're an employer, you don't have to hire a regular employed W-2 worker anymore. It's so much easier to hire them via these apps. In my book, I talk about it. The book is not just about the gig or, you know, Uber, in other words. It's about, you meet people in the book like Chris Young, who's a auto worker in Tennessee at a Nissan plant. And Chris is doing the same thing as his coworkers, except he doesn't work for Nissan. He works for a contractor. And as a result, he gets half the pay, pretty much no safety net, no job security. You meet other contractors and temp workers and part-time workers who today are subject to what they call just-in-time scheduling, where you don't even know your schedule from day to day or week to week, so it's impossible to plan your life. At that point, a part-timer's working conditions are not that different from someone in the gig economy. So, it would be a mistake to focus just on what's happening in the gig economy. My book is more about what's happening to jobs as a result of technology, and the gig economy is just part of that.
So, listeners, do you consider yourself a part of the gig economy? the so-called sharing economy? Do you want to call in and talk about your experiences, good, bad, or mixed? For our guest, Stephen Hill from the New America Foundation, author now of the book Raw Deal, How the Uber Economy and Runaway Capitalism Are Screwing American Workers, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. I've definitely met people who are happy with their so-called sharing economy lives, including Uber drivers who like that they can do this part-time and not have to deal with the suits at a taxi fleet company, or people making extra money with their homes through Airbnb. There is a certain liberation for people to a peer-to-peer business model, even if, you know, the middleman company takes a cut. Could you be painting with too broad a brush?
No, I don't think so. I mean, it's certainly true that some people are able to make it work. I mean, it's better than having no job at all and sitting on your couch and watching television all day with no income. But, you know, I get this question a lot, like, oh, I had used Uber and I talked to the driver and he said he's enjoying it. I always ask them, how long has that driver been driving? Because I've talked to a lot of drivers who say quite the opposite. And the thing that the trend that I've seen, and I think Uber's own numbers back this up, is that the longer you've been driving for Uber and the more hours per week you drive for Uber, the less you like it. If you're just doing it a few hours a week and you've only been doing it for a month or two, it seems kind of good. But Uber's own numbers show that half of their drivers only last a year on their platform. And 80% of them are driving part-time. About half of them are driving 15 hours or fewer. So this is basically a very part-time temporary job, and if it works for you, great, you should do it. But, you know, and no question it's created more convenience for consumers, especially compared to what taxi cab companies had become, these sort of types of cartels. But there's significant labor issues around Uber, environmental issues around Uber with congestion and traffic getting more difficult in some cities like San Francisco and New York. You also have issues around, I mean, for example, Uber, classic examples, they had a report from co-authored by Alan Krueger of Princeton an economist at Princeton. And the Krueger report found that the drivers were making anywhere from $17 to $30 an hour, depending on the city. But the report didn't even take into account what drivers' expenses are. And it didn't even, you know, the drivers' expenses can be quite significant for gas and for insurance and, you know, a lot of the expenses it takes for driving. But and also the data came from October 2014. The report was released in January of 2015, timed for the Conference of Mayors because Uber was trying to impress those mayors. And then 2 weeks later, Uber cut the pay of its drivers. And this happens on a fairly regular occurrence where the driver's pay gets cut, both on the end of how much the driver earns per mile, and then Uber taking a higher and higher percentage of the driver's pay. When Uber first started, they took 5% of the driver's wages. Now they're up to 25%, and for some services, 30% of the driver's wages. So the drivers are getting squeezed on both sides, and that's why I say if you've been driving on the platform longer and you've been subject to a number of these pay cuts, and so you're receiving less money today than you were when you first started, you tend to not be very happy driving for Uber. And Uber's having a hard time recruiting drivers. Down the street from where I live in San Francisco, they set up a table at the gas station, which is kind of comical that this high-tech company would set up a table like a bake sale. And they were going up to men at the pumps trying to recruit them to become drivers because they're having such a hard time hanging on to drivers. I mean, if drivers were making that much money, it was going so well, why wouldn't they drive it for longer and for more hours per week?
Before we get off Uber itself, have you done a comparison of being a full-time Uber driver and being a full-time, say, yellow cab driver in the traditional taxi industry in New York? Is one better than the other?
No, I think they're about the same. You know, one has a bit more security in being a taxi driver. The Uber, you have the sort of the flexibility, as Uber likes to say. But even there, it's not as clear cut as Uber makes it out to be. Recently in Los Angeles, about 350 drivers were kicked off the platform by Uber because those drivers' acceptance rates of passengers was not high enough. And the reason why it wasn't high enough is because as the congestion increases in the cities, if you get a fare, that, you know, is only going a mile or two as a driver, you know you're not going to make any money on that fare. You're going to be stuck in traffic for that whole time. And so they just are not accepting those rides. And so Uber has kicked these sorts of drivers off the platform. So that's, you know, I mean, if you really are an independent contractor and you really are the CEO of your own driving business, as Uber and these other sharing economy companies like to say, why shouldn't you be able to accept or reject passengers as long as it's not for reasons of race or anything like that, just because you think you're not going to make enough money on that one? And yet, you know, Uber exerts significant control over these drivers on that platform.
Giorgio in Manalapan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Giorgio.
Hi, Brian. I love your show. I listen all the time.
Thank you.
No, I was listening to your show today, and I'm a restaurateur here in New Jersey. And also, I feel the pressure of this gig economy. You know, we have to be part of Open Table. We need to be part of all these new app-based businesses, which are taking away a piece of our business, and we are filled with our back against the wall, that we need to be part of it. Otherwise, our customers will go somewhere else. They do reward their customers, you know, with points, with incentive, with money, with check, which we're paying for it. And the margins are getting always smaller and smaller. And, you know, I feel like the old bookstore. You know, I feel that we're getting squeezed by the big chains and by all this app-based, you know, the Groupons, the this, the that, that are really hurting us.
You want to shout out the name of your restaurant in Manalapan or no?
Yeah, sure. Cold Fire Pizza in Manalapan, Solo Trattoria in Frijo, New Jersey, and Town Craft Burgers in Englishtown. I actually own three restaurants,
good.
And that's why I feel the pain.
Good luck, Giorgio. Thanks for calling.
Fill out a little bit more of what he's going through. You know, the companies that he's competing against, these app-based companies, they're all being subsidized by venture capital funds. It's not clear that any of these companies are earning a profit at this point, even Uber. The venture capital money comes in, and there's, you know, in Silicon Valley, there's a big smoke and mirrors culture where you always have to make it seem like what you're doing is the latest, greatest thing to keep that venture capital flowing in. And so, you know, here's someone who's trying to make it work with his business, and he doesn't have that kind of venture capital to subsidize his prices, to make things cheaper for the customers, but he has to compete against companies who are being subsidized by that kind of money. And it is really hard for the small mom and pops to go up against these big Silicon Valley companies that are being subsidized by private money.
And he mentioned the apps. How are Uber and many other gig economy apps exploiting what you call in the book the independent contractor loophole?
Well, what they're doing is they're hiring contractors instead of regularly employed people. And contractors, if you hire a contractor as a business, you don't have to pay for things like Social Security, Medicare, health care, or even injured worker compensation, unemployment compensation, let alone paid sick day or sick days or paid vacation. None of that. So your labor costs are going to be about 30% cheaper than someone who is paying that. And so, you know, if I'm doing this, Brian, and you're doing this and you're not doing it, it puts pressure on you to have to start considering cutting back on your regularly employed workforce in order to compete with me. This is what I call the independent contractor loophole. And this is where I think the real problem with this gig economy is. It's not so much that it in itself has become this big, huge thing. There's a lot of debate about how big it actually is. But it's pioneering a new type of technology that makes it easier to hire and fire workers and to hire the contractors and hire the freelancers rather than regularly employed workers. An example is, and this wasn't even a gig economy one, but it shows you the direction that many of these businesses are going. The pharmaceutical company Merck, they had a plant in Philadelphia. They sold the plant to another company. The company lays off all 400 workers, hires all 400 workers back as contractors, and then proceeds to make the same drugs for Merck that Merck was making before. This is the danger of what is happening in our economy, where more and more employers are going to this contractor-based type of business.
Seth in Ann Arbor, you're on WNYC. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. I drive for Uber in Ann Arbor, Michigan, University of Michigan. And I just wanted to say that the flexibility of being able to go on Uber, drive whenever I want, or go off Uber, take breaks whenever I want, it kind of cuts both ways because on the one hand, you know, if I have another bill to pay, I can drive a lot more that week, make a lot more money. But on the other hand, I'm just constantly aware of the fact that on a Friday night, if I go out to dinner, you know, with my girlfriend, I might be missing out on $30-$40 an hour. And it just makes it kind of difficult to plan your life when you have that kind of uncertainty and also opportunity costs.
Seth, thank you very much. And you write in the book that this is taking us back to a pre-New Deal economy. Why do you put it in those terms?
Well, because the New Deal is what gave us what we know as the safety net today. And as more and more workers become contractors and freelancers, they don't have a safety net anymore. And employers before the New Deal weren't thinking about how do I provide a safety net for my employers, or even how do I keep training increasing their education so they become more productive at work. Employers didn't think about those sorts of things because people, you know, engaged with an employer for a very short amount of time. It was more piecework. And instead of having a single employer, you had multiple employers. And so we're sort of drifting, I think, without even having a good societal discussion about whether this is a good or bad thing, we're sort of drifting into the same sort of model where more and more people are doing piecework. And as I said, you don't get paid for looking for the next job. You don't get paid for training or for going for meetings or for upgrading your skills. You have to do all that on your own time and dime. I mean, I sometimes say it's as if, you know, imagine Eli Manning, the New York Giants quarterback, only got paid for when he threw a touchdown pass. And all the other plays and all the other training and that he has to do doesn't get paid. It's on his time and dime. That's what the gig economy is like. And increasingly what it's like for part-time workers, too, who aren't receiving any safety net and are subject to this just-in-time scheduling where you don't even know what your schedule is from day to day.
My guest is Stephen Hill, senior fellow at the New America Foundation, author of a book about the gig economy called Raw Deal. In June, Stephen, I spoke with Robin Chase, co-founder of Zipcar, on the show. She's a proponent of the sharing economy, obviously, and says that it is a more resource-efficient system, for one thing, allowing for localization and customization. She did acknowledge that regulations are necessary, but recommended putting that burden on the company, not the government, such as Uber doing its own background checks. She also suggested that there are benefits to moving toward an economy in general in which people hold multiple jobs, likening it to a company or government's need for diversification. Here's a clip of her explaining that.
That every company and every government is thinking, I want to make sure that, or the city of New York, we're not just tourism, we're tourism and finance and technology. We want to diversify our revenue base. But when it comes to the smallest economic unit of all, you or me, an individual, we're suddenly told, you know what, you only get one job. And it's going to be, we've made ourselves so fragile, like anything can break and then we're unemployed. But I think we should. There's other benefits to working many jobs at the same time, and one of them is economic resilience so that we aren't screwed when we lose that job.
So even using one of the words at the end there from your book subtitle,
right?
What does Stephen Hill say to Robin Chase?
I mean, she's just really missing the big picture. And this is the type of rap you get from the Silicon Valley-based companies and investors all the time that somehow this is going to be great for you. And in fact, it's not great for many, many people. I mean, sure, it's working for a few people that need some extra money. But the idea that somehow having multiple employers, none of whom pay for anything having to do your health care, even injured worker. I mean, many of these gig economy workers get injured and they don't have injured worker compensation. They're on their own. They can't work anymore, and they don't have enough savings to help them while they're injured. How is that better? I just don't see that's the case. I mean, a classic example, you know, Airbnb. It started out as a good idea, and if it was correctly regulated, it still could be a good idea. The idea that someone has a home and they want to rent a spare room in that home, make some extra money. What could be wrong with that? Especially in economic times that aren't so good. Well, here's the problem with that. Airbnb has drifted very far from that original mission, and it's now become completely invaded by professionals, professional landlords, property managers. You know, in New York City, you've had some hosts who had over 200 properties they were managing. You know, and in fact, recent studies that have been done show that 44% of the visits coming through Airbnb in New York City are with hosts that have multiple properties. The Attorney General of New York last year had a report showing that almost 40% of the revenue coming from Airbnb were from hosts that had three or more properties. These are not regular people. These are people, you know, I've interviewed people in the book. You'll read tenants in San Francisco who have been evicted by property managers and landlords who have turned entire buildings into Airbnb hotels. They evict everyone in the building, including seniors, disabled people who have been living in these buildings for 15, 20, 25 years, and suddenly they are out in out on their backs out of on the streets, and while they turn it into properties for tourists. And so what Airbnb has become, this platform that pits the local needs of residents and their housing needs versus tourists. And they're taking the housing stock and putting it into play. And, you know, this is why city after city years ago passed laws saying you can't rent out for fewer than 30 days so that you didn't turn your housing stock into something that pits tourists versus locals. And Airbnb, this technology has ripped open a giant loophole that allows these professionals to do this without getting caught. And San Francisco actually passed a law in February that went into effect, and it completely hasn't worked because no one has the data to know who's renting out to whom for how many nights, how do you tax it. Airbnb has refused to pay taxes in most of the 34,000 cities where it's operating. So, you know, again, Robin, I think, needs to look at the bigger picture of what's happening instead of this kind of theoretical idea that somehow we'll all be better with multiple jobs. I do have in my book ways that we could make a safety net for workers who have multiple employers, but that's not in place now. And instead, you know, most of these workers are having a very hard time with it.
Ann in Forest Hills, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ann.
Hi, Brian. I just wanted to say, I reiterate what your guest has said, which is that the whole social safety net is eroded by this. Things like workers' comp and disability and even jury duty. For example, in New York, I know that in some courts, if your employer is not paying for you to be on jury duty, you're released, which means that pool is shrinking. The other thing, which I didn't say to your screener, is that I think tax authorities have a much easier time getting withholding taxes than they have to getting the estimated taxes. So we're basically working our institutions harder with less.
And thank you. So before you go, what do you think we should do about all these problems that you're identifying at the policy level? And for example, in Wednesday night's Republican debate, Carly Fiorina, who of course has been CEO of HP, was asked whether or not she would support the government playing a larger role in setting up retirement plans for freelance workers such as Uber drivers. And this is how she responded.
Every time the federal government gets engaged in something, it gets worse. And then the government steps in to try and solve the problem when we get a little further down to that progressive vision that Hillary Clinton is talking about. Companies should, if they want to attract the best workers, provide a good set of benefits. But honestly, if you're a small business owner today, you are being crushed.
So how do you respond to people like Carly Fiorina, who would suggest that a system of individual security accounts would be too much for small businesses to handle?
I don't agree, because if everyone's playing by the same rules, so in other words, if all the businesses have to do it, then no one's hurt more than anyone else. You know, it's simply the case that the proposal that I have in the book is to create individual security accounts for each worker. And then every employer who employs that worker, whether that worker is a contractor with them or a regularly employed part-time or W-2 worker, that employer would pay a certain amount into that individual security account prorated to the number of hours that worker works for the business. And then that money would be directed into the existing infrastructure that we have for safety net, including Social Security, Medicare, injured worker, unemployment compensation and what have you.
Do they do do they do that in any countries today? Are there models out there?
Yes, this is virtually what all developed countries do. We're kind of the outlier in this regard. I mean, most countries don't treat different classifications of workers so differently. I mean, that's part of the problem, is that we treat part-time workers and temps and freelancers and contractors much differently than we treat full-time employed, regularly employed workers. And this is for historical reasons, coming out of the New Deal era and all these sorts of things. And now here we are in 2015, and this old way of doing things just simply doesn't fit the workforce today. So the type of proposal that I put forward, it's basically an insurance plan. And so in any insurance plan, you always try to pass the cost on to the biggest pool possible. The biggest pool possible in this case would be consumers. So employers would pay – I use Bureau of Labor Statistics numbers to figure out how much it would cost employers to pay. It would be about $2 more per hour above the wage for service sector workers. And then they would pass those costs on to their customers. And a lot of those customers will be the very people who are benefiting from having this safety net. So a rising tide would float all boats. So it seems to me this is very doable. And as you mentioned, it's already being used in many other parts of the world. I think that these are the sorts of things that we have to start looking at more seriously. And more people are starting to look at them more seriously. Members of Congress and various businesses and sharing economy. I was in a meeting a few weeks ago with some of them, and they're saying, yeah, we've got to do something. This is not going to work going forward, because here's the problem: if not enough consumers have enough money in their pockets to buy up all the goods and services that the businesses are producing, that's when you get into just ongoing recessive forces in your economy that become very difficult to reverse. So there's a lot at stake in really figuring this out and not just simply saying, oh, I like Uber. My driver says it's working for him.
Stephen Hill, senior fellow at the New America Foundation, is author of the subtly titled book, Raw Deal, How the Uber Economy and Runaway Capitalism Are Screwing American Workers. Thank you for discussing it with us.
My pleasure, Ryan. Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And now a call in for your stories about unintentionally going viral. Has this happened to you? Share your stories at 212-433-WNYC. We asked this today because we learned that recently NPR's Becky Sullivan, a producer of All Things Considered, appeared on Jeopardy. Her response to a question in the final round of the game show spread across social media. The category was flowers, and the contestants were shown a photo of a bright pink heart-shaped flower hanging from a stem. Alex Trebek, the host, said the flowered picture here is called this, also a disparaging term for people on the political left. And this is what happened when Alex Trebek read Becky Sullivan's answer.
I have a feeling that you may have found a way to insult liberals in this country. Let's take a look at your response. What is a pansy? Yep. You found a way to insult liberals in this country, and you are incorrect. So you're not doing yourself any good financially. You're going to wind up in second place. You lost all of your money. Over to Sean Anderson now, who could not be caught. He was at 15,600, and he wrote down the correct response. What is a bleeding heart? Although I do like pansy.
And so in a story Becky Sullivan wrote for NPR about her experience going viral, she said, I wrote down the name of the only flower I could think of that could also be used as a disparaging term, which was the question, by the way, that the flower or an answer, because you have to pose your answer in the form of a question. But it was also a disparaging term for people on the political left. So I don't exactly get why she then got flack for disparaging people on the political left. But anyway, this was an inadvertent joke, and it received 1.2 million views on Jeopardy's Facebook page and was even the subject of a bit of a roundtable discussion on CNN. Poor Becky Sullivan. So listeners, the question is, have you or someone you know ever gone viral unintentionally? Call us at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. It doesn't have to be on the level of Becky Sullivan's story where you garnered millions of views on social media or were featured on television. It could be more like an example from, maybe right here in the WNYC offices where a staffer's internal email about her stolen kombucha tea from the office fridge made it onto the Gawker website. Or maybe you're one of those people who've been photographed on the subway for your peculiar behavior or outfit. Remember in March 2014, there was a photo of a man who brought out a folding table